Well, last week, those of us who were here, we heard a wonderful testimony. This wonderful testimony of Nebuchadnezzar as he recounts the amazing way in which God had humbled him and yet brought him to trust in the Lord, to rejoice in the Lord. It was wonderful. This great king in that chapter writes chapter 4 himself and declares God's goodness to him, what God has done for him, and honors the Lord and praises him, the God who lives forever. That was wonderful. It was encouraging for us to hear that. But not every story is like that. Not everyone does what Nebuchadnezzar did in humbling himself. And here's a story before us this morning, a real story of a man who refused to humble himself. And it's a solemn story for us this morning. Verse 22 of our chapter is a key verse, the key verse in many ways, where Daniel says to Belshazzar, "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this, and you have lifted up yourself up against the Lord of heaven." Wow. So what sin, can I put it like this? What sin will keep you out of heaven? What sin will bring you under the judgment of God? Now I know in one sense the answer is any sin and every sin. But there's another way we can think about it. In one sense, only one sin will keep you out of heaven. There's only one sin that will keep you out of heaven and mean that you cannot be saved, and that is the sin of pride. The sin of refusing to humble yourself before God. Don't misunderstand me when I say this, but in some ways it doesn't matter how terrible a crime, a sin you've committed, or how many sins you've committed. God is able and ready to forgive. Jesus Christ's death is powerful enough to deal with any sin and every sin. But there's one sin that will stop you from coming to God and knowing that forgiveness. And it's pride. A refusal to submit, a refusal to bow, a refusal to come and acknowledge your sin and need and cast yourself on the living God. And that's what we're reminded of in this chapter this morning, the man who wouldn't bow. Now, when we come to chapter 5, we're jumping on from chapter 4, about 40 years in between the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. So Nebuchadnezzar is now long gone. And we're introduced to this other king, Belshazzar, and he's already been reigning along with his father Nabonidus for a number of years when we get to this account. We know from other historical records that during the events of this chapter, Nabonidus, who didn't actually very often live in Babylon, but he was fighting the approaching armies of the Medes and the Persians while his son remained in Babylon. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're just going to make our way through this sobering chapter and see what we can learn from it. Now, whoever you are, I hope that you'll be able to understand this morning. You children, you'll be able to understand this story as we go through it, as well as people watching online. So, but let's just make our way through it. So first of all, verses 1 to 4, I've just given this, if you have a sheet, that let the party go on. Let the party go on. So Belshazzar holds a party, doesn't he? He holds a feast to which he invites 1,000 of his lords. So it's a huge party. And not only are there 1,000 lords there, verse 2 tells us, he invites all his wives and all his concubines along as well. Concubines were just extra women that the king had that he wasn't married to. And no doubt, judging by kings of the time, there were a large, large number of them. And so what sort of feast is this then? What sort of feast do the dignitaries of Babylon have? Well, basically, It's just a big drinking party. Did you notice in those first four verses, each verse, the writer mentions that they are drinking, that the wine is flowing. It's clear that this feast is just a big opportunity to get together and get drunk. Clearly, as the evening goes on, everyone's getting more and more drunk. The whole occasion is getting more and more rowdy as they begin to sing the songs to their various gods, as you see in verse 4. And with the wives and the concubines there as well, we can imagine this is not an innocent party. We know the sort of things that went on. We know what happened when the worship of the gods of Babylon, lots of them were fertility gods, and all sorts of immorality went along with them. So that's the scene then that we're faced with as this chapter opens. Belshazzar's having this great party, the drinks flowing, the fun started, the singing started, on they go with this party. So what can we say then? We look on this scene. What are we to think? Well, the first thing we can say is things haven't changed very much, have they? Things haven't changed very much with the passing of the centuries, even though COVID may have made it a bit more difficult for us for a while. It's still how people entertain us. It's still the motto of the day, isn't it? Eat, drink, and be merry. That's the motto of the day. You win the cup final, you get drunk, you pass your exams. Well, let's have a party and see what happens. You survive the week. Oh, it's a weekend. Let's party. Now, as I say, of course, the last year has spoiled that a bit, hasn't it? But that's what many people are looking forward to. Get back out, let the party get going again. Let's get back to it once more. And it's something, isn't it, that crosses national divides and social divides. It's the activity of the rich and the poor, the king and the commoner. You know, the rich might have a better quality wine, you know, as opposed to cheap lager or something like that. But basically, it's the same thing, isn't it? Eat, drink, and be merry. And we're reminded, aren't we, of those words in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 9 and 10. You remember when Solomon is surveying things? He says, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it can be said, see, this is new? It's been like it's been done since ancient times before us. And it's fascinating, isn't it? How culturally different Babylon all those years ago would have been to 21st century Britain. And yet, there's this way in which there's nothing new under the sun at all. Now, of course, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with a party. There's nothing wrong with a drink. But this is a drunken, godless, most likely immoral party. Notice a couple of other things about this party that we learn from it. First of all, this sin never satisfies. It always leads you to worse sin. So here they are. I've no doubt they had these. Well, they were known for these sort of parties, the Babylonians. They were famous for them. This is nothing new for them. To get drunk was nothing new for Belshazzar and his lords. But they're always looking for something new to do. Something to make it a bit more exciting. Because sin very quickly gets boring. And you're looking for something new to do. And so what does Belshazzar decide? Ah, he gets a great idea. I know what we can do to make this all a bit more interesting, all a bit more fun. Let's get the vessels from the temple of God that Nebuchadnezzar brought from Jerusalem. Let's get them. Let's drink out of them. Let's defy the living God a bit more. And so that's what they do. They're brought in. The command goes out in verse 2, and the whole thing sort of sinks even lower, doesn't it? These precious vessels that were made, dedicated to the living God and were for use in his worship, are now being used to drink to the gods of the Babylonians. That's often the way sin goes, isn't it? It sort of goes downhill. It gets boring. And so you're looking for something to make spice it up a bit. And on it goes. Then another thing just to notice about this is this, that it's why I've given this point the heading, let the party go on. It only becomes clear at the end of the chapter that this party takes place while the Empire of Babylon is on the verge of collapse. We know from again, from other records, and we know from the end of the chapter, that Babylon is at war. The enemies, the Babylonian enemies, the Medes and the Persians, are nearing the city. His father, Nabonidus, is out fighting them. They're going to be in the city before the night's out. The empire is on the brink of disaster, but the party must go on. Here's what to do. What better way to pretend that everything's all right, to forget about everything? What a better way to bury your head in the sand than a good party? Let's get the party going. And that's often how life's lived, isn't it? That's often what people do. Just try and... It might not be getting drunk. It might be the next box set from Netflix or whatever it might be. Whatever it is that people turn to just forget everything. Forget all that's going on. Forget that we're swiftly heading through life. Forget that whatever it might be is going on. Let's have a party. There's the first thing then, as we survey this scene. Here's Belshazzar, the enemy's at the door, and let's on with the show, on with the dance. The second point, the party ends. Just briefly, look at verse 5 and 6. So here's the scene. Yeah, we can imagine it, can't we? The wine's flowing, the party's in full swing, the songs are getting louder, the laughter's getting louder. God's being defied with his vessels being used for the worship of the Babylonian gods. And then suddenly, something happens, doesn't it, that brings it all to a juddering halt. Singing dies away. You can picture it, can't you? Something happens that turns the king and his guests into a quivering wrecks. Children saw that picture, didn't you? Well, I'm sure it was worse than that, wasn't it? The fingers of a man's hand appear and write, inscribe on the plaster on the wall behind the king. What does the king? Look at verse 6. The king's countenance changes. The blood drains from his face. His eyes nearly pop out of his head. His legs give way. Without wanting to go into too much detail, the joints of his hips were loosened. Well, that's a euphemism. For the king wets himself, basically. That's how terrified he is in the moment. And it's amazing, isn't it, how quickly a scene can change. One moment a scene of laughter can be turned to terror. It only takes a moment, doesn't it? It only takes something to happen. And that's often the trouble, isn't it, with the pleasures of this world. That it doesn't take much to bring them to an end. It doesn't take much to unsettle a person or trouble a person. I mean, it's happened at parties, hasn't it? An earthquake, a fire, a tsunami, a bomb, a heart attack. With Nebuchadnezzar, you remember in chapter 2, what was it that troubled him? It was a dream that God gave him. Here with Belshazzar, it's a mysterious inscription on the wall, and suddenly the party's over, isn't it? And this man is left terrified. The party ends. And the party does end in the end, doesn't it? Everybody's party, everybody's life. Well, let's think thirdly about a wise man remembered. Now we're looking at verses 7 through to 23. So verse 7 tells us the king screams out, doesn't he? He says, cried out aloud. He shouts out to bring in the wise men, bring in the Chaldeans, bring in the soothsayers. He wants the writing explained. He wants the interpretation. And so they're all rushed in. And you can imagine the king watching on anxiously as they all look. And none of them can answer. None of them can give the interpretation. Not one of them. The king's even more troubled, isn't he? Look at verse 9. He was greatly troubled. His countenance changed again. He's just... The blood strained out of him. His lords are astonished at the sight of him. But then the queen comes in. Verse 10. Now this is most likely Belshazzar's mother, Nabonidus' wife. Because verse 2, back in verse 2, tells us Belshazzar's wives and were already at the party. And the queen clearly hears the commotion, hears what's going on. And when she comes in, she finds out that the wise men can't answer this riddle, don't know what these words are all about, and her thoughts immediately turn to someone. And that somebody, of course, is who? It's Daniel, isn't it? It's Daniel. Now, as I said, we know that there's a period of about 40 years between the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. Nebuchadnezzar's now long since died. Nabonidus and his son have been reigning for a long time. And obviously, clearly, at some point, Daniel's been put out to grass, hasn't he? He's been forgotten. He's been sidelined. He was, of course, the main man for a long time, the main man to Nebuchadnezzar, but not anymore. He's been forgotten. He's been put out to grass, and you can imagine that happening, can't you? I mean, when you're trying to have fun, when you're trying to have a party, to have a godly person like Daniel around spoils the fun, doesn't it? So he's put out of the way and forgotten about. No more need of him. And so he's left and he's forgotten. But in a time of crisis, when something like this happens, a wise man is remembered. And what a description it is the queen gives, isn't it, in verse 10 of him. She uses her own pagan sort of language and terminology, but what she says is quite something. There is a man, verse 11, in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. That's a testimony, isn't it, to Daniel and to his witness and to his life for all those years. His life's still remembered. The wisdom he displayed, the holiness of his life, and the fact that God was so clearly with him, and immediately in a crisis, oh yes, I know who to call. We know who to get. You remember? Daniel. Brothers and sisters in Christ, is a challenge to us this morning that our lives and our characters and our words be such that though people might not want us around when they're having their fun, when the crisis comes, when life turns upside down, that they think, ah yes, I know who to go to, I know who to speak to, I know who will tell me the truth, I know who can give me some wisdom, I know who will have something to say. I wonder if our lives are like that. That when people get into trouble, and when the lump's discovered or the trial comes, they go, oh yes, here's the person I need now. That's a challenge to us, isn't it? And so Daniel's summoned, isn't he? And in verse 13, we just see how bold and faithful Daniel is. I mean, he's just so great, isn't he? Try and imagine the situation. Now, he's been out in the cold for at least 15 years, probably more. He no longer holds the prominent position that he had. And in the middle of the night, then there's a knock on the door, and he's got up, and the king wants to see him. It's his chance, isn't it? It's his chance to get back in there. It's his chance to sort of regain his position and regain the favor of the king. All he's got to do is be nice. Don't say anything too bad. And you're in, Daniel. That's the temptation, isn't it? I'm sure. And Belshazzar butters him up, doesn't he, in verse 13? No, oh, I've heard these fine things about you, promising him jewelry in the kingdom and third place in the kingdom and so on. How does Daniel respond? Isn't it great? Think about it. I mean, we've heard about him in the last chapter, but there's a gap, isn't there, of all those years. What's Daniel been doing? We don't know. How's he been living? Has he forgotten God? Has he gone soft over the years? Here's him speaking after 40 years. Verse 17. Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. I don't want your gifts. I don't want your rewards. You can give them to somebody else. I'm not concerned for your money or your prestige or your position. But I will tell you what God says. Isn't that wonderful? It's a great joy, isn't it? That Daniel's not changed. He's not gone soft over the years. He's still walking with God. He still fears God rather than man. And he's ready to speak at a moment. Even in that pressured situation, He's ready to speak and he knows what to say and he's going to be faithful to God. And brothers and sisters, there's another challenge for us, because we never know when we're going to be called upon to speak. We never know when we're going to have an opportunity to say something. We never know when we're in this day and age in which we live, when we're going to be faced with that pressured situation. Do you really believe this? Do you really stand for that? And so it's so important, isn't it, that we're always ready, if you like, that we're walking with the Lord, that we trust the Lord, that we're prayerful and that we fear God rather than men, so that we're ready for when that moment comes. Now, we can't do that in our own strength, of course. And next week, we'll find out the secret of Daniel's life. But that's how we're to be. And so he begins to speak, doesn't he? But he's so bold, isn't he? Because he didn't just go, okay, here's the words, here's the interpretation. He begins by looking Belshazzar in the eye and addressing him, isn't he? He reminds him about Nebuchadnezzar and what he was like and what happened to him. Look at verse 18. Let me read it again. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened and in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. He was driven from men. And till the end of verse 21, till he knew the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. He reminds him, Belshazzar, you remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And he did know, didn't he? He says that in verse 22. Very bold. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all of this. I wonder, had Belshazzar done what we did last week? Read the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather. Had he read it? He knew it. He knew it. Whether he'd seen it himself or whether he just heard about it, being told about it, he knew. He knew what had happened. He knew what his grandfather had written. And what does he do? In spite of it all, he hardens his heart. He won't humble himself. And what does he do instead? Let me read verse 23. Look at verse 23 with me. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you. And you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold and bronze and silver, wood and stone, which don't see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Wow, I mean, that is brave, isn't it? This is what you've done. You've been a fool, Belshazzar. You've worshipped gods that can't help you, that can't see, that can't come to you in your moment of need. And the God who holds your breath in his hands, you haven't worshipped. Well, that's so easily true of us, isn't it? If we're honest, we'll worship so many things. We'll make idols out of anything. We'll worship our possessions, our money, our family, our hobbies, our homes, or whatever it might be, and they can't see and they can't help us. And the God who holds our breath and gives us our every breath, we ignore. Is there anyone here this morning doing that? Anyone watching online doing that? This God, the living God who has your breath, who gives you every breath you breathe in, is from him. What a foolish thing to worship idols and despise the living God. Well, let's come to the solemn message then, the last thing. Verses 24 to 28. Having spoken so bravely and so straight, in such a straight way to Belshazzar, he then explains the words and their meaning. So let's look at them. You children, you can see them there. I don't know if they're in capitals in your Bible. They are in mine. The first word is the word mene, and it means numbered. And what's the interpretation? Well, it's there, isn't it, in verse 26. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. In other words, the mighty Babylonian Empire, which seems so strong and sure, Its days were numbered. Its days were over. It's finished. That very day was the last day of the Babylonian Empire. God brought it to an end. He'd said that he would. In those dreams, he's the sovereign God. He raises up, brings down. Kingdoms come, kingdoms go. But it wasn't only the kingdom that was numbered. It was the king whose days were numbered as well, wasn't it? His days had come to an end. Here he is, drinking and carrying on as if life was going to last forever with no thought for death. And yet that very night he was going to die. Solemn fact, isn't it? That people come to the last hour of their lives without realizing it, without knowing it's coming. People get up in the morning and they don't know it's the last time they're going to get up. I mean, we don't know, do we? I don't know what happened on that crash in Great Elling today. I hope nothing terrible happened, but somebody got up this morning. Little did they know they're going to have a crash. People get up every day, don't they? Little did they know this is their last day. And people, of course, live as if there was never going to be a last day. But we don't know, do we? And our days are numbered. And they're numbered by God, the God who gave us our first day, will bring about our last day. And we can't, they're numbered. It's going to happen. But what do we need? We need to be ready for it to happen. Not by somehow finding out what the date's going to be, but by trusting in the one who's conquered death. By trusting in Jesus. Second word is the word tekel, which means weight. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. God, in other words, had weighed up all the actions of his life, all the actions of Belshazzar. Here he was. He was a man who weighed up other people's lives and made decisions about them. But here's the living God, and he weighs up Belshazzar's life, and he knew all his sins and all his drunkenness and all his pride and all his, all that he'd done, all his thoughts. And God knew them all. And he's found wanting. His life is weighed up. And it's a solemn thought, isn't it? That's true, isn't it? God weighs up our lives. He knows everything about us. He knows all your secrets, all my secrets, all the things that I'm glad you don't know about me. He knows. And it's all weighed up. And what's the measure it's weighed against? You know, is it the neighbor down the road? No. It's the law of God, isn't it? That we love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. And we've just not even begun to do that. So we're looking for somebody else, aren't we? We're looking for help outside of ourselves. In the light of that. What's the last word? Well, in verse 25, it's you fasten. And you might be a bit confused because when we get to verse 8, there's a different word, perez. Well, apparently that's just the singular of the word you fasten. And Daniel just uses that word instead. And it means divided. And the kingdom's been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Suddenly, all that he has, all that Belshazzar has, it's taken from him and given to somebody else, and he's left with nothing. And that's what happened that very night. He's slain. The enemy enter the city, and his life is ended. That day that had begun with, well, the evening that had begun with drunkenness and feasting, ends with death and judgment. It couldn't be more solemn than that. And That's what we're being faced with then this morning. Yes, that wonderful chapter 4. Praise the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar comes to his senses, bows before the Lord, rejoices in him, trusts in him. But what about his grandson? It doesn't happen with him. And how much more solemn for someone like Belshazzar, who should have known better, who'd seen in his grandfather. Can I be straight? Some of you here this morning are like that. You've seen other people bow the knee, come to faith in Jesus, and yet you're holding out. Your parents, your grandparents, somebody else in your family. And they've bowed and you've seen it. You've seen God work in them and yet you're holding out. Oh, don't be like that. Come and bow before this great God. Come and trust him. Come and cast yourself upon him. Here's a king whose kingdom's never going to end. Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. And he calls us to come. He says, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he's near. Let the wicked forsake his way. The unrighteous man his thoughts. And turn to the Lord and he will have mercy on him. And to our God, and he will abundantly pardon. That's why I said there's only one sin, in a sense, that will keep you out of heaven. Yeah, and it's pride that will stop you bowing and seeking this great God. So come, Jesus Christ is ready and able and willing to save all who come. And he opens his arms this morning and says, don't be fooled. Come to me. Find life and peace and hope and joy in me.